here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
Today is Friday, the 6th of March. I'm Rohith Joseph.
And I'm Emily Blake. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia. To our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:06 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent, campus, local, and international news. Today's top stories and segments are a conversation with Associate VP External Jude Krasta about Vancouver's upcoming transit referendum and how it'll affect students.
We also sat down with Ann Kessler, VP Academic of the AMS, to talk about tuition policy. Then we have your science and tech update with Marco.
We also have a piece on the Vancouver Community Network and their new initiative that provides Vancouver's homeless with online access to information about shelters and safety alerts.
Then I sat down with Sally Thorne, former director of the UBC School of Nursing, to talk about Ethel Johns, the founder of UBC's nursing program, who was recently named a person of national historical significance by the Canadian government.
And for our final segment, I will be talking about a UBC collective called the Good Getters. But first, for some headlines for today. In campus news, Justin Trudeau visits a UBC campus on Wednesday afternoon. Justin Trudeau, leader of the Liberal Party of Canada, gave a short speech and spent roughly 40 minutes answering questions from the audience in the Student Union building's ballroom. There was some controversy prior to the visit, with both students and faculty posting on the Facebook page for the event, wondering if there would be a question and answer session. At first, the young Liberals at UBC who were hosting the event responded by saying there would not, but Trudeau would be available afterwards in a casual meet and greet with students. This was met with outrage and calls to boycott the event, resulting in the young Liberals clarifying that, quote, the event is a Q&A style event, as per all young Liberal hosted events with Justin Trudeau, and deleting all posts other than their own from the Facebook event page wall. The event itself was extremely well attended, and the ballroom occupancy was maxed out. Trudeau encouraged all students to, quote, take ownership of their country and get involved. He answered a variety of questions on the environment and, he also addressed First Nations affairs and his party's controversial stance on Bill C-51. Student media, including reporters from News 101 at CITR, the UBC, and the Terry Project, and students from the School of Journalism, spoke with Trudeau afterwards in a scrum-style media conference lasting a little under 15 minutes. Tune into our show next week for a feature-length segment with tape from that discussion.
And in local news, chemical fire in Port Metro Vancouver extinguished after over 24 hours. On Wednesday afternoon, at around 1:30 p.m., a chemical fire started in a shipping container in the port, quickly spreading to three containers. The chemical on fire was caused by a bleaching agent and industrial disinfectant. Fire crews worked overnight to contain the fire and ensure no flare-ups occurred. The cause of the fire is still unknown, and an investigation has begun. Terminal employees were evacuated from the port immediately, although at least three people were hospitalized due to respiratory issues caused by smoke inhalation. Although Vancouver Fire and Rescue are monitoring air quality on site, the effects that smoke inhalation will have on the people in the surrounding area remains to be seen.
In national news, NDP leader speaks out about new anti-terrorism bill C-51 and Islamophobia. Federal New Democrat leader Thomas Mulcair spoke out about the new anti-terrorism bill C-51, a bill that he believes contains serious flaws and undertones of Islamophobia. Bill C-51 gained significant traction in Parliament after the tragic events in October of last year. On October 22nd, Michael Zihaf Bibo killed Corporal Nathan Cirillo, a soldier who stood guard at the National War Memorial in Ottawa, and just 2 days prior, Martin Couture Rouleau killed RCMP warrant officer Patrice Vincent. Both Bibo and Rouleau were believed to be self-radicalized jihadists who suffered from debilitating mental illness. Mulcair cited that there was a lack of evidence to the claim that the Bibo and Rouleau attacks were acts of terrorism. In an interview with the TAI, Mulcair said that Bill C-51 fails to provide proper oversight of authorities and allows the federal government to meddle with domestic activism or movements that it may view as a threat to policy. Mulcair also stated that the Tory government is, quote, pandering to Islamophobia, when it recently challenged a court ruling that permitted a Muslim woman from Mississauga, Ontario, to wear a niqab, a type of Islamic head covering, during a citizenship ceremony in order to win support for Harper and Bill C-51.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
Sunday, March 8th is International Women's Day. Tune in to CITR between 12 and 8 p.m. for FemCom programming focused on female musicians, artists, women's issues, and more. For the full programming schedule, visit www.citr.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have a conversation with Associate VP External Jude Krasta about Vancouver's upcoming transit referendum and how it will affect students.
So Jude, where does the AMS currently stand on the transit referendum?
So AMS Council has officially endorsed a yes side on the transit referendum. It took us quite a while of research and looking at the mayor's plan to decide that this was a good option for students, and it really benefited students in the long run versus the minimal amount that they would potentially have to pay in terms of a tax increase. Currently, we're looking at a 0.5% increase to the provincial sales tax to fund a whole host of projects like a new Broadway line, a new B line onto campus, new bikeways around Metro Vancouver, and a lot of other improvements that really make it better for students to have access to transit.
And so you're currently the Associate VP External. The current AMS VP External, Bahara Joker, has been actively involved with Get On Board BC and the Better Transit and Transportation Coalition as the student co-chair. What has this process been like for your office?
Oh, it's been extremely hectic. I remember December 11th was when we were at the Mayor's Council meeting in New Westminster, and that's when they had officially released the question that they were sending to the provincial cabinet. And from then on, there's been no looking back. Winter break barely existed for us, and so did reading break. But it's been a fun process. It's been a lot of stress, but the good kind of stress where you know you're making a difference. This is the first transit referendum in Canadian history, and so it being valued at $7.5 billion that really supports students among other interest groups is something that we really hold dear to us.
So it's been productive.
It's been extremely productive. Like, we've met a lot of stakeholders. We've met people from labor unions, from environmental groups, from business leaders, other student unions who we've never actually worked with before, apart from the regular group that we work with. And it's been an amazing experience to work with them.
Recently, UBC President Arvind Gupta publicly urged for a yes vote on the referendum. Has there been much coordination between the AMS and the university administration in this regard?
We have been having a lot of cooperation with the university, especially for on-campus events. We are planning a whole host of campus events to take place soon. Once we officially launch the hashtag WeSayYes, Students for Yes campaign on March 11th, we'll be looking at we've already started with coffee for commuters regularly starting 8 a.m. Twice a week, and we are currently in talks with the university to have to expand our on-campus outreach to different sections of the campus population.
Currently, those on the no side of the referendum have criticized the Vancouver Transit Authority for having incompetent executives. And just 2 days ago, they received a Lifetime Achievement Teddy Waste Award from the Canadian Taxpayers Federation for over 100 examples of waste within the organization. I'm sure you've heard about this.
Yeah.
Given that the AMS is pushing for a yes on the referendum, what can be done to hold the Transit Authority accountable?
So basically what needs to be emphasized to the general public is that this is a referendum about transit improvement. It's not a referendum about whether or not we like TransLink or the way it's being governed, though that is a valid issue in the eyes of many voters. One thing that we do have to emphasize is that saying no to this referendum would not necessarily affect TransLink in any possible way, but saying yes actually shows that the voting population is committed to reforming our transit system, and it would really highlight the need for a better governance structure within TransLink once we demonstrate that we actually care about our transit system by saying yes to this plan.
Why hasn't an internal review been suggested on the ballot?
So the way that's currently taking place, it's not necessarily a ballot issue felt by the Mayor's Council. What the Mayor's Council did put on there to make sure that we do have an accountability structure in place is independent reports and auditing. It's not necessary. It's not really a blank check to TransLink for $250 million a year. They will be held accountable to each of the projects that have been mentioned in the preamble to the ballot. Currently, as people already know, there has been a little bit of internal reshaping in TransLink, and currently we hope to see more take place sometime soon.
Where can students go to get informed about this referendum?
So there are a number of places the students can go to get informed. The first platform I would suggest students go to would be www.studentsfor4yes.ca. I also encourage students to go ahead and get registered to vote on the Elections BC website, and to sign the Vote Yes pledge for the Better Transit Coalition on bettertransit.info. All this information, though, is available on studentsforyes.ca. So if they log onto that website, they can click ahead and sign the pledge and get registered to vote at the same time.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Jude.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Costa. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Interested in producing a professional music video? No dough. Public Records is giving away grants of up to $5,000. Apply now through June 14th at publicrecords.org. Winners will have their video showcased on TELUS Optic TV and online. So head on over to publicrecords.org to get your application underway today.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have Moira Warburton, who sat down with Ann Kessler, the VP Academic of the AMS, to talk about tuition policy.
I'm here with Anne Kessler, who is VP Academic for the AMS, and we are going to be talking about the AMS's tuition policy. So, Anne, what is the AMS's current policy on tuition changes?
Well, we currently have no policy on tuition. We had a policy that expired in August. Our policies used to expire every 3 years, and so that one expired in August. We were had seen it coming. We're preparing draft changes, but due to some turnover in the committee, hadn't gotten them ready until about the beginning of October. But of course, as we all know, at the beginning of October, we got a big announcement about a big tuition increase. And so when we brought it to council, they were concerned. They felt that it was a sort of rushed at that moment, and so decided, and also felt that it wasn't necessarily reflective of the referendum that happened in January of 2014 around tuition, and so sent it back to the committee and then voted specifically on the 10% tuition increase so that we could take a stance on that particular issue. And so we've taken it back and have looked at it again and tried to make it fit more closely with the referendum that happened in January 2015. And so it came to council a couple weeks ago for a first view. We're taking it back to the committee and doing some revisions, and we hope to have it back pretty soon. Pretty much the changes are that the policy used to pretty much say, you know, we're okay with the annual 2% increases, but nothing more than that. But the new policy looks to be more closely to say we want to advocate for reduced tuition, and we're not okay with the sort of annual increases.
So there was a change proposed because it didn't fit with the new developments?
Yeah. So one of the sort of one of the reasons that we sort of provided to council as to why we should be adopting this policy is because students asked us to take a stance on tuition. And so council at the time felt that given that the referendum question asked us to advocate for lower tuition, that our policy should reflect that.
So what changes specifically do you see will be made, or do you hope will be made?
Pretty much it's a total rewriting of the policy. So it'll sort of outline that we're not okay with annual increases. We're especially not okay if international student tuition is raised at a higher percentage than domestic student tuition. For the past several years, the university has raised new international student tuition by 3%, whereas new domestic student tuition by 2%. And so it'll outline that we're not happy with those things. It'll also outline that we want to advocate to the government for increased funding for the university, because we think that tuition decreases should be matched with increased funding, because we don't want the university to suddenly have a huge deficit. And also to advocate for the government to put a freeze on tuition.
So what will this policy mean for the AMS? Like, how will it change the AMS's actions in this regard?
I'm not sure that it'll change what we really do. We've always advocated to the university, you know, to say, just like with this 10% increase that recently happened, we're not happy with those increases. We used to sort of be like, you know, we're okay with a 2%, which we won't be doing anymore. And we've always been advocating to the provincial government for more funding, because it's a huge issue. We know the university is in a tight place.
And that 2% was to account for inflation, yes?
Yeah. So actually happening right now is the university's annual consultation on tuition. There's a town hall on March 16th. So that'll be 2% for domestic students and 2% for continuing international students.
Okay. And after this policy, do you think that the AMS will lobby harder for increases in funding from the provincial government?
I mean, I think we've already been lobbying pretty hard. I'm not totally apprised of all the details because it's a bit outside my portfolio, but I know that we've met with the Select Committee on Finance in the fall about tuition when they were putting together the budget. We've, just a couple weeks ago, our VP External spent a week in Victoria lobbying various ministers and members of the Legislative Assembly. And so I think we've been working hard, and I think we're going
to
continue.
Yeah, that's
fair. So, and we've been working quite extensively with other British Columbia institutes in something called the Alliance of BC Students. So we've been, and that represents a significant portion of all of the students in British Columbia, and so we've been working together with them to advocate all together as a united voice.
Great. Well, thank you for coming in today.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Moira. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
Be intrigued and inspired by years of research and groundbreaking ideas in a matter of minutes. Attend a 3-minute thesis event on March 10th or 12th, featuring powerful research presentations from UBC graduate students in 3 minutes or less. Attendance is free this March 10th and 12th. Check out the website 3mt.grad.ubc.ca for event times and location.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us. For our next segment on the show, we have your science and tech update with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is your latest science and technology news. In our first story, this concerns the world's largest land mammal, which is the elephant. Many of the elephants in Africa are disappearing. In the last 3 years, 120,000 elephants have been killed by poachers. The tusks are usually seized, and lately, Environment Canada arrested someone in Toronto, and they seized tusks from a Toronto auction house that were deemed illegal. And the way that they deemed that they were illegal was due to radioactive dating. According to international law now, any elephant tusk that was obtained before July 1975 is legal, and it's classified as an antique. But to stop the elephant poaching, any elephant tusks that were obtained from elephants that died after July 3rd, 1975 are deemed illegal. So Environment Canada used a new technique for the first time to convict a Toronto-based auction house. The director of the auction house, Chun El-Jin, was fined in February after he was convicted of possessing 4 illegal elephant tusks. The fines are small, $9,000 for Chun and $9,000 for his company, but he had to surrender the 2 tusks. As I mentioned, from 2012 to 2014, poachers killed 120,000 African elephants only for their tusks. The company claimed the tusks were legal, but with radioactive dating techniques, they ascertained that the elephant was killed about 1978. Guillaume Lebrec of the Radio Chronology Lab in Quebec in Laval University said, "You can't really argue with this. The facts are right there." Radioactive carbon dating involves using an isotope of carbon, which is carbon-14. When plants, animals, or trees are alive, they take in carbon-14 from the atmosphere. After they die, they do not take in the carbon anymore. So the carbon starts to decay. Scientists can look at the ratio of carbon-14 to carbon-12, which is the most common isotope of carbon, and this allows timing of the death to be extrapolated. So this auction house was convicted, and the director also. Elephants are the world's largest land mammals, and there's an increased chance of extinction because poachers are slaughtering elephants for their tusks. The ivory in the tusks is the slaughter of the elephants is blamed on increased demand for ivory, and specifically in China. In our next story, I'm talking about a self-hybrid flying car. The Anim TFX, a 4-seated hybrid electrical car, is now being made, which features vertical takeoff and landing, and it is a flying car. The car is called Terra Fuga, made by Anim TFX company. They drive like a normal car, but they also fly. They have propeller blades in the back that unfold, and the wings or the nansets tilt upwards or tilt down for forward flight or for driving. The vehicle would reach 200 miles an hour driving and could fly for 500 miles. It takes 5 hours to learn how to operate the car/aircraft. The propeller is at the rear, it takes over the flight, and while in flight, it'll recharge the batteries. The car also comes with parachutes in case something goes wrong with the flight. Stay tuned. Look at www.driven.com tofly.com for more information on this flying hybrid car. This is Marco. You're up to date with the latest science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is Monday.
From 1 to 3 p.m.
Who is this guy? Does he have a name? Does anybody know where he's from?
From parts unknown.
My name's Chris Horrific.
You always wanted his character to be bigger than life.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is without question the greatest sports and entertainment event of all time. Be a part of it Monday
from 1 to 3 p.m.
The Parts Unknown Show on 101.9 CITR. Sometimes cosmoses collide.
Parts Unknown!
Break your fingers!
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Rohith Joseph. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have a piece on the Vancouver Community Network and their new initiative that provides Vancouver's homeless with online access to information about shelters and safety alerts.
The Vancouver Community Network is a nonprofit organization that provides free internet and cell phone services to assist individuals and community groups so that information, resources, and opportunities on the internet is accessible to the homeless in Vancouver. Recently, the VCN has created a street messaging system to alert disadvantaged and vulnerable people in Metro Vancouver with information about shelter, food services, health alerts, and employment opportunities. With the increase of the homeless population in Vancouver, the VCN is working towards using these cell phone services to help end street homelessness. This is Chasey Axelson, the executive director of the VCN, here to talk more about the VCN and the street messaging system. Can you tell us a little bit about Vancouver Community Network and the organization's main goals?
Sure. The Vancouver Community Network is an ISP provider, so it's an internet service provider for people who want free access to the internet. We provide basically dial-up service for free in Vancouver, well, anywhere that this would be a phone line, as well as technical support for free, and, you know, we'll do web hosting, a lot of good work for organizations in the Lower Mainland.
What are the services you provide, and how does it benefit the homeless people of Vancouver?
Oh, sure. Well, the services that we provide are primarily around internet communications technology.
Okay.
So we will not only help people understand how a computer works and give them training and support, we'll take them through how the internet works. We'll also, again, we provide free access to the internet. We do provide free Wi-Fi in some of the shelters here in Vancouver as well,
mm-hmm.
and free Wi-Fi in the Woodward's building as well. More recently, we started, we launched a program called the Street Messaging Service. Sorry, the Street Messaging System is a web platform that allows for social service agencies to send text messages about, you know, various things around shelter, food, health, hygiene, jobs and training, so people who have registered their cell phones on the system.
How do homeless people, for example, access the cell phones?
You know, we've been actually doing quite a bit of research on cell phone use in the sort of vulnerable populations, and we're finding that 8 out of 10 people have cell phones already. I know it seems surprising, but frankly, a cell phone is really, really important to you and I, and it's actually even more important to someone who may be struggling with poverty or have challenges with where their home is. Without a home line, of course, the cell phone becomes the one way that people can always reach them.
Are there ways to maybe get the other, you said 8 out of 10 people, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, how about the other? I know it's a small population. Yeah. are you doing anything to maybe get in contact or get in touch with those people?
Well, you can register an email on the system as well, but primarily the system is designed for people who would be, you know, it's more immediate messaging. It's messaging around a shelter, potentially, you know, there's spaces available, or, you know, it's been shut for the day because of a fire, flood, you know, whatever, or there's free food that's being delivered on the corner of whatever and whatever, so that, you know, people can get there. It's kind of more emergent and immediate. It's a true sort of billboard in a way, an electronic billboard for people to get information about whatever it is they need in order to improve their lives.
How long have the services been running?
We started the pilot project in September. We got funding from the Canadian Internet Registries Authority. They have a community investment project that was giving away about $1 million a year for organizations that are looking to help disadvantaged and vulnerable people. And so this is a program that we kind of developed. It's, interestingly enough, I did some work at UBC, and I found out about the, you know, sort of alert system that they had there for students. If there's an emergency on campus, you'll get a cell phone sort of text from the administration. And I thought, well, we can do that. And so we did.
Did the organization face any difficulties since it was founded?
The street messaging system or VCN? Because the Vancouver Community Network was actually the first way that people, like just general people in Vancouver, had access to the internet. So it was called a free net 20 years ago. So in 1993, we started providing internet services for people to, you know, get on the internet and find out what was happening on what they called then the World Wide Web. It wasn't until 1997 that TELUS even thought that it was a worthwhile thing to start asking people if they wanted to pay for. But we've always done it for free. So there's always going to be challenges. You know, one of the big challenges that we have with VPN, I suppose, at the moment is maintaining relevant in a broadband and Wi-Fi world when, you know, what we have to offer to the entire population of Vancouver is free access, but via, you know, dial-up. But we're still, you know, doing that stuff to cross the digital divide and get people learning and knowing more about internet communications, and it's been a blast.
So on a lighter note, do you have a rewarding experience that you would like to share during your experience with VCN?
Wow, there's so many. You know, we actually get letters from people who tell us how important our work is, and I think that for me is a big reward, is when you know, because it is sort of, you feel a little bit like you're working in a bubble, like you're not working with people every single day, you're kind of working across wires, and you don't really think about how that might be impacting people's lives, but, you know, certainly the senior citizens that we work with, and, you know, some of the people who have challenges. For instance, there was one fellow who has a Facebook site that he runs, you know, particularly highlighting missing women and people, missing people across Canada. And, you know, his computer died. He didn't have access, and we were able to outfit him with a free computer. Because that's just one of the things we will do. We have a redundant computer, we'll do that. And he was so glad, so happy that we were there to help him when, you know, he lived in, you know, below the poverty line, well below the poverty line. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's pretty great. We also helped the Acorn Society in New Westminster in the same way. I don't know if you remember, about a year and a half ago, there was a massive fire that took out some of the historic districts in New Westminster. And one of the organizations there was a society that we were, you know, able to go in, rewire their offices when they found new ones, and actually provide them with redundant computers that we had as well, all for free.
What are some ways people can get involved, so the public or community members?
Mm-hmm. We're always looking for volunteers. Mm-hmm. You know, people are able to phone our technical support lines for free and get help with whatever computer issues they might be having. So So we always need volunteers to help us with the helpline. We do work at the UBC Learning Exchange as well, so I know that they, you know, often need help, and we will actually get some interns and do much of that work too. We do often need help with, you know, certain workshops and things like that. You know, I hate to say it, but always spending money, you know, to help people who can't usually afford what, you know, internet access on their own. That's, you know, always a good thing. And, you know, just generally thinking about the digital divide and wondering how we can make sure that it's equitable and democratic as possible, you know, and sending us insights. I mean, UBC students are so brilliant. It would be great to see ideas from them, even just ideas of what the digital divide means and how we can cross it more efficiently.
This is Akira Shu reporting for Groundwire at CITR 101.9 FM on the traditional land of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations in Vancouver.
Thanks to our newest contributor, Akira Shu, for that piece. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but please stay tuned for more News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM.
I'm gonna be round my vegetables. I'm gonna chow down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite vegetable.
Sprouts. It's your 75-cent coffee fix in the sub. It's your source for reasonably priced, creatively named stew and vegan brownies. It's your purveyor of bicycle-delivered local produce. It's also a place where volunteers can realize their vision of responsible business and where like-minded students can explore UBC's food systems.
Hark! Sprouts is currently accepting applications for next year's executive board and is encouraging ambitious, creative, and disciplined students from all faculties and year levels to apply.
Come by Sprouts in the sub-basement to learn more about our projects and how to get involved.
I tried to kick the ball, but my tinny flew right off. I'm red as a beet, 'cause I'm so embarrassed.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, or online at citr.ca. Thank you for being with us. Up next, we have Emily Blake, who sat down with Sally Thorne, former director of the UBC School of Nursing, to talk about Ethel Johns, and the founder of UBC's nursing program, who was recently named a person of national historical significance by the Canadian government.
Would you mind telling me a little bit about Ethel Johns?
Well, Ethel Johns was this incredibly feisty woman who came to British Columbia in 1919 to be the director of Vancouver General Hospital. And this was an interesting time in history because World War I had just happened. And for the first time, the Canadian public had become aware that nurses actually make a difference in things like the war and recovery of soldiers and battlefield. So there was quite a lot of press about nursing. And instead of it being kind of a background invisible thing that just happened in the world, it had suddenly had a little bit of social importance. And then the year after the war, the worldwide Spanish flu epidemic happened. And people were really realizing that there were some significant challenges. And she was able to convince the government of the day that to deal with public health problems, what you needed was a knowledgeable nursing workforce, which was quite revolutionary. When UBC became the first Canadian program to have a university degree-based nursing education, it was actually the first one in what was the British Empire at the time. So it was a pretty big deal. There were some in the States that were at that point in universities, but this was certainly the first in Canada and beyond. And it was many, many years before Britain and Australia and other places started to do that. So it's an interesting message that still holds today. We're still trying to convince the government you need a knowledgeable nursing workforce to solve public health problems.
And is Ethel Johns' presence still sort of felt in the UBC Nursing School?
Very much. Now, there's other parts of Canada that want to claim her. Ottawa, because she was editor of the National Association's Journal for some time. There's Americans that want to claim her because she did a lot of international work and development of nursing schools in Europe and that sort of thing. Winnipeg, where she did her own nursing training. But the work she did at UBC, although she was only here for about 5 or 6 years, it was just groundbreaking. She really set the stage for doing things differently. And her name has continued to be used in the school and in the local community and around the province. We have, for example, every year an Ethel Johns Research Day, and that brings students and researchers from all around the province together for a day or a day and a half to share ideas. The name Ethel Johns turns up in quite a number of places, you know, the old nursing school residences and various other things. So it's a name that we've really celebrated, and there haven't been that many directors of the School of Nursing. I think we're just on our 8th in that 100 years. 1919 will be 100 years old, so it's a pretty big deal.
And what role did she have to play for women's rights and equality?
Very much so. She later actually went to the States and did lots of work with the Rockefeller Association and other groups, particularly on minority nurses. And she did writing. I mean, the writing of that day we would look at today and see all kinds of challenges with it. But essentially it was very strong feminist language. She was very convinced that nurses had a legitimate role to play in the healthcare system. They needed to be autonomous. Well, medicine wasn't here at UBC for some 40-odd years later, but she really did see it as an academic discipline that had a scientific basis, which is quite interesting because it took the rest of the profession quite a lot of years, you know, another 20 or 30 years before it was beginning to even use language like science to understand nursing's basis. Up until that point, it was just a thing girls did, and, you know, it was something that was seen as sort of a natural, normal aspect of family life as opposed to a professional practice. Of course, Florence Nightingale and others had really made inroads on epidemiology and evidence and science in the early years, so it wasn't unheard of. But the idea that nursing actually was legitimately placed in a university was quite revolutionary. She had lots of pushback from the sciences at UBC. She had lots of pushback from physicians in the medical community, because medicine wasn't at UBC either at that point. And she certainly had, you know, pushback in government, but she was able to just roll up her sleeves and bully her way into the situation, take advantage of a really good opportunity.
And what allowed her to be so successful at UBC rather than elsewhere?
I think that she was an excellent critical thinker. She could see the nature of the situation, the wider social context in which she was operating. She was a very good networker, and she was very funny, actually. She, you know, was quite kind of sharp and pointed in her speeches. She could kind of embarrass people using a bit of humor. She was not afraid of anybody or anything. So she was, you know, one of those people that others really rallied around and stood behind and just rolled up her sleeves and got things done. No muss, no fuss. Let's solve it and let's be sensible.
And do you know sort of what the process was for her becoming a person of national historical significance?
Yes, we're very lucky in BC. We actually have, there's not that many nursing historians in the world, but we're very lucky to have quite a large collection of people here in British Columbia, including a lot of UBC alumni. Some fabulous people from the class of 1958, for example, who've really taken some leadership in recording nursing history. And there's a group from the VGH and a group from UBC alumni that really put a lot of effort into tracking this historical information, gathering data, which is not all that easy in old historical records. There is a book that was written about Ethel Johns' life, and that was really helpful, by a former faculty member of UBC many years ago. And it was quite a long process, probably about 5 years. I was involved in the development of that, but I certainly didn't take a lead. It was a wonderful collection of senior nurse historians, and took about 5 years, I think, to be able to make that case back and forth with Parks Canada on behalf of the Government of Canada. And I think that you really do need to be able to demonstrate that there's something quite special about that person's life. It's certainly not an ordinary kind of honor. So they were able to do that, and there aren't very many nurses. I don't know if there are others. Perhaps there are, you know, from the really old days, but it's a very rare thing for a nurse to be recorded in that particular way.
And what impact is this recognition having on the department, or will it have?
Well, there's the kind of sentimental attachment that really fuels the pride of UBC as actually having been the site of something that has been a leader in how nursing education gets delivered since 1919. Obviously, a baccalaureate degree as entry to nursing practice has gradually become the norm around the world. It's still not universal. But it was much, much later, you know, 20 years ago or so in the UK, that nursing really found its way into the universities in a meaningful way. So UBC, because of being the first and because of always seeing itself as a leader in that way, really has advanced nursing education in different ways. It's, in Canada, certainly one of the very small number of world-class research-intensive nursing academic units. It still has scholars that are world-class. It does really creative, innovative programming. It's always trying to be sort of one step ahead of whatever is needed next, to test it out here and then try and encourage others. So it's a school that has really taken on that sense of itself as having a historic role to play and a particular role in the province and the country. The other thing in this UBC campus, I don't know if you're aware of it, but the School of Nursing has actually never had its own physical space. It's been squatting since 1980 in the acute care hospital, which is, you know, Vancouver coastal space. It's not academic space. It's converted hospital space, so you can imagine it never did quite fit what we needed. So we are very much hoping that this, along with our own centennial, and we'll celebrate the university's centennial, but when it's our centennial in 2019, we're very much hoping that that can spur people into some enthusiasm to really finally be able to create the conditions under which we can have an actual building. My goal in life before I retire is that people on this campus will be able to say, "Do you know where the School of Nursing is?" We have visitors from all over the world because it is a world-class institution, and they're just stunned by the physical space that we have. We're hiding in the third floor of that hospital. So at some point, we would like it if students and faculty and staff and people who are part of this university community could actually know where the School of Nursing exists.
Do you think there's any other progress in the future for the UBC Nursing Department?
Oh, there's lots. The faculty and the students are doing just incredibly interesting work. A lot of the work that we're doing now is really focusing on the social determinants of health, which is actually what Ethel was on about. She didn't have that language and that way of thinking about it. But we have nurses doing fabulous programs, not just of research, but community action development, knowledge translation, shaping the way things are done differently in social pediatrics, which is the way you set up infrastructures to ensure that children aren't left behind in places like the downtown East Side, people working with sex trade workers, people working to set up whole new ways of thinking about long-term care and home care for the, you know, increasing population of dementia. So they're really dealing with what are the current really hardcore, difficult challenges, working with communities to better themselves. And this kind of work is really attracting increasing numbers of people from around the world to come and see how we do things and learn from us. So we've got lots and lots of collaborations with nurses and certainly physicians, social workers, physiotherapists, planners, people from all over the world. So I think the thing that really characterizes the School of Nursing is that it really has been always interested in social action kinds of research. And it attracts that kind of people and it spurs on students who do amazing things.
What do you think Ethel would think now if she could see the UBC School of Nursing?
Oh, of course. I think she'd be absolutely thrilled. I think that a lot of things would feel unfamiliar to her because, of course, at that time, there was kind of a boundary between what was health and what was somebody else's domain. But I think that she would very quickly pick it up. We've had groups of alumni that come back for their anniversaries, their big ones, 50 or 60. And often they're kind of nervous to come to the School of Nursing. They expect us to be a bunch of hardcore researchers and they don't think it's going to look like what's familiar to them. So they come a little bit defensive sometimes, just not knowing if they'll feel comfortable. And as soon as we take them into those clinical skills labs and they see students, you know, putting in catheters and doing injections, and they suddenly get it, that the core of nursing has always been what it is. It's that really, you know, sensitive, compassionate, thoughtful, informed care of individuals, but in that social context. So it's quite interesting to see that recognition, that even though the students of today might look and walk and talk a little bit differently than you remembered your colleagues in their starched little white caps, as soon as they start talking, you hear nursing.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for your interest.
And thank you, Emily, for that piece.
Now, Rohit Joseph is in studio with us to talk about a UBC collective called the Good Getters.
In order to talk about the Good Getters, I first must mention Francis Arevalo. Now, Francis Arevalo is an art student at UBC's Vancouver campus, and he's been making positive and lyrical contributions to the community for a long time now. So in order to set things up, here's a little clip of what Francis is about and how he's trying to get the good-getters to do good.
My name is Francis Ravelo, and I love to rap. My stage name is Aloe.
Kinder Morgan and sleeping in Irving. Jurn exam season, dreams of candor for the cannon. Find any man to listen. I got lost while I was building, yelling. Which Buchanan is this?
I'm a fifth-year English major and psychology minor here at UBC, and I work as a residence coordinator at Tilden Park. With my English major, I gained an appreciation for language and for metaphors and for narratives, and I learned that different words mean different things to different people. And in psychology, the most important class that I took was Psychology 208, called How Social Psychology Can Help You Succeed. One reason why that class really resonated with me was that it gave me tools and concepts and vocab to best understand myself so that I can participate in this very, very complex world that we all live in. And for the first time in my life, my studies, my work, and my passions all align. So that's why I created the Good Getters Collective.
What your passion is, the thing that you, like, really excites you, whatever that is. Second, I want you to think of the work that you want to do. And third, I want to think of how you can contribute externally from the Good Getters and internally within the Good Getters.
Basically, I want to connect musicians, artists, entrepreneurs, activists, and really any other passionate people so that we can help each other do what we love.
I get down, not talking about dance, felt warden defeat. I ain't talking about vans, pretending to be eloquent to handle this helplessness and heaven on my mind. Now I rap for the hell of it. Daily wordplay and mixed wits, call it crosswords, composed with composure, awkward love raps and good posture. Best to be an optimist, prime like Optimus. I get it now, bit off more than I can chew, so it makes sense to spit it out. Plus now with quick talk, it's so hard to be cold, and yes, we jock a bit, so we ought to be bold to close distance with contraction. Use words for bonding, it seems we're all unique, and that's all we have in common. It seems that's all you need, so get to writing songs.
So Rohi, as one of the musicians involved, what can you tell me about the Good Getters?
So the Good Getters is a group of like-minded and creative individuals. Some of them are musicians, some of them are artists, like graphic designers, or some of them are even aspiring entrepreneurs. So it's a group of people at UBC who are all passionate about these various things. And in a way to make these passions come to fruition and become a reality, it's part of the Good Getters mission to connect these people with different talents that complement each other and that can help them reach their goals.
So how can people get involved?
So people can get involved actually this weekend, which is what I would like to extend an invite to anybody out there who wants to improve in their passionate field, whatever that passionate field of choice may be. Are you perhaps you're a musician who wants to improve your songwriting skills. Perhaps you are a photographer or videographer who wants to improve on your editing and framing. All of these kinds of people who are masters at their craft will be at the Good Getters Open Space Workshop, also called the Good Getters Academy, this weekend. And it's literally happening in a place called This Is Open Space on Columbia Street, 434 Columbia Street. So what you can do is you can come in between 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. to check out what's going on. It's just drop in and you can learn from people who will be hosting songwriting workshops or artistic design workshops and see what you want to take out of it. And this way you can be a part of this scene, see what creative people at UBC are getting up to, and perhaps yourself be inspired to do something with it. So the space is a set for a culmination of creativity, invigoration, and renewal with good vibes, music, food, arts and crafts, workshops, and even video games and basketball to relax. So if you want to check this out, come by this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, anytime between 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. at 434 Columbia Street at a building called This Is Open Space.
And what is the website if people want to look up more information?
If you want to look up any more information, you can check out www.thegoodgetters.com or you can look up The Good Getters on Facebook and check out more updates on the Facebook page.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Emily.
That's our program for today, March 6th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@CAITR.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, CAITR.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday after 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Emily Blake.
And I'm Rohit Joseph. Today's broadcast was produced by Marco Prodanovich. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Stranded right here on CITR 101.9 FM. And to close off the show, we have a number 17 hit on CITR's charts this week. This is Alter Coles by Anime off their EP, Sallows.